So, over the last couple of weeks, we've been reflecting on a series of vices, which I will admit felt really great in my head, but every week walking out and being like, let's talk about gluttony, let's talk about lust. It's a lot. If it's a lot for me, it's probably a lot for some of you as well. But I guess just to say, you're not alone. I have found that reflecting on the virtues is so encouraging, but it does feel like sometimes the vices get all the mental attention. And so, I feel like we're on this journey for a reason. We're going to keep going, but there might be a time for meditating on these virtues in particular. And I guess that just to say, each week we're kind of using the vice as an anchor and a hook in because they're more familiar to us. But if you're finding the weight of these vices, these topics, even in your own psyche, as you just reflect on your own life, do encourage you to meditate on those beautiful virtuous words as well. Like, the words that we've been able to look to, like last week, contrasting lust with chastity, and thinking of chastity as not this heavy, oppressive thing, but as, what you see is what you get, as purity, as being able to see right through the thing, and to be able to treat people in our lives with that sort of clarity and that sort of pure love, that's so encouraging. And so I guess this week we're looking at envy, which is another one of those ones that could really bum you out if you meditate on it too long, because, envy's got our number in our culture right now, but to also keep in mind the gifts that come on the other side of these vices, virtues that really do offer us a way forward in unity and in community and in love together. Okay, the text we're going to be reading from this week is from the book of Genesis. I wanted to go all the way back into the Old Testament or into the Torah, into the first five books of the Bible for this topic of envy, because it's fascinating to see a story that is, sort of before time. This story is so ancient. Before the Israelites were even in Egypt, this story was a part of their history. And so reflecting on such an old story that ties in so powerfully with such a modern concept like envy, I think it helps us see how these spiritual realities that we encounter, like envy, the spirit of envy, has been around a long time, even longer than just Jesus, has really gone back to primal humans telling the first stories. The stories that shaped God's people are shaped by this story, the story of Joseph, who you might recall had a fabulous jacket. So fabulous, we wrote musicals about it and talked about it forever. This is a story about Joseph. Many of you will be familiar with beats of the story. I'm not going to read the whole story. We're just going to read the introduction. I'm going to even skip through it a little bit just to keep us moving, but I do want to offer a bit of commentary. So I'm going to read the text, and at 3 points, I'll pause from the reading just to make sure we're tracking along because I want to jump through a little bit. You're welcome to read along. It's in Genesis chapter 37. Genesis will be the first book of the Bible in your pew Bibles. You're also welcome to listen. I just don't want you to confuse my commentary with the text. So I'll try to differentiate that, but just expect I'll give commentary 3 times. As we read through this text. Sound good? Love that energy, man. Really buzzing this morning. I'm with you. It'll be contemplative. A reading then from Genesis chapter 37, beginning in verse 1. Got a couple of characters here. We've got Jacob. Jacob has a number of children. His youngest child's name is Joseph. So you'll hear reference to Jacob, two of Jacob's wives in a polygamous culture at the time, and their children. You'll hear reference to all that, and then you'll hear reference to Joseph, the youngest of Jacob's sons. And Jacob dwelled in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. This is the lineage of Jacob. Joseph, 17 years old, was tending the flock with his brothers, assisting the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, the wives of his father. And Joseph brought ill report of them, of his brothers, to their father. And Jacob loved Joseph more than all his sons, for he was the child of his old age. And he made him an ornamented tunic, and his brothers saw it was he, their father, loved more than all his brothers. And they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. So, beginning with our text, we've got this character Joseph. Joseph is not seen as like the best guy. He goes to work with his brothers, then comes back and tells his father a bad report about his brothers. So Joseph isn't like necessarily a good guy or like a great guy. And then his father, because he loves his tattletale son so much, creates for him an ornament tunic, like a coat of many colors all weaved together, all decorated, which Joseph wears, which is totally not a great move. It's like posting your fancy dinner on Instagram. You don't do it anymore, right? Like, there was a time where you could show off wealth and people were kind of fine with it, but now the tides have turned, right? People are like, don't go showing off your nice things. It's rough out there. Well, Joseph is the favorite brother. He gets a fancy jacket and he's parading it around. Look at me. Look at all my ornaments. You know, it's just not a good look. Then we read later, and I'm not going to read this part to you, but we read that Joseph has some dreams. His dreams, he then goes and tells his brothers about. His one dream, I will read what he says. He says to his brothers, this is so younger brother, any of you with like younger brothers, this just feels classic. He says to his brothers, listen, pray to this dream that I dreamed. And look, we were binding sheaves in the field. And look, my sheave arose and actually stood up. And look, your sheaves drew round and bowed to my sheave. Weird dream, eh, guys? What do you think that's all about? Like, just really. It's like, yeah, no wonder they threw you in a ditch, man. Like, were you in your fancy jacket when you told them your dreams? There's a second dream that he tells where he calls in his mom and dad to tell them about how they too will bow. So it's not that Joseph's a great guy, but what we see very quickly is that his inability to be humble is met very quickly by the hostility of his brothers. His brothers who can't speak a good word about him. Later on in verse 18, they devise a way to get rid of him. The brothers are out working in a place called Dothan. It says, and Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. And they saw him from afar before he drew near them. And they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to each other, here comes that dream master. And so now let us kill him and fling him into one of the pits, and we can say a vicious beast has devoured him. And we shall see what will come of his dreams. So this is their plan. One of the brothers, Reuben, speaks up. And Reuben heard and came to his rescue and said, we must not take his life. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood. Fling him into this pit in the wilderness and do not raise a hand against him. That Reuben, might rescue him from their hands and bring him back to his father. And it happened when Joseph came to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the ornamented tunic that he had on him. And they took him and flung him into the pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread. And they raised their eyes and saw, and look, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, their camels bearing gum and balm and ladanum on their way to take down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, what gain is there if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and our hand will not be against him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. Okay, so pause. They decide we're going to kill him. Then they're like, you can't kill your brother. That's wrong. Throw him in a ditch. Okay? Then they're like, but if he's in a ditch and he dies, we don't get anything. So what if we sell him? And then they end with this line. You know, we'll sell him to the Ishmaelites, and then our hand will not be against him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. It's like, I don't know if it counts, you know, we didn't murder him. We were going to throw him in a ditch, but then we sold him as a slave. He's our brother, you know, I don't know. We'll get to envy later and the ways that it plays with our logic, the ways that we justify actions that are clearly wrong when we're stuck in envy. But we see them already justifying in their mind how this will be a better way. So they sell him off. Now we'll continue and finish in verse 31. And they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a kid goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the ornamented tunic and had it brought to their father. And they said, "This we found. Recognize, pray. Is it your son's tunic or not?" And he recognized it and he said, "It is my son's tunic. A vicious beast has devoured him. Joseph is torn to shreds." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So here at the end of the text, we get this poetic line, "A vicious beast has devoured him. Joseph is torn to shreds." And I think Jacob is speaking better than he knows. Jacob has been told that the vicious beast that devoured his son was a wild beast, an animal. But the vicious beast that has devoured his son is indeed a real beast. It is the beast of envy. A spiritual beast has corrupted his family. A spiritual beast has worked its way into their hearts. A spiritual beast has turned sibling on sibling, family on family, has led to layers of deception, both self-deception and the deception of others. And in the end, the words that are spoken are true in a way that Jacob wouldn't have been able to prove. That a vicious beast has devoured him, Joseph has been torn to shreds by it. So if we had to name the beast of envy, how would we name it? A couple interesting things to note about envy. Most of the vices give us something in the short term, but eventually take more than they give. So you think about greed. What does greed give you in the short term? A little bit more of everything. More resources, more money, more stuff. But in the long term, what does greed do? Well, it takes away from us our compassion. It takes away our connection. So it gives us something that we can hoard, but over time it eventually takes more. What does gluttony do? It gives, but then it takes from us. What does lust do? It gives us something in the short term, but over the long term it takes. And so all of the vices seem to offer something in the short term, the immediate, but then over time they dismember, they disfigure the human being until they take more than they ever gave. The one exception to this, from my estimation and from what I've been reading, is the vice of envy. Because envy doesn't give us anything. Envy isn't about wanting what someone else has. Envy is about wanting them not to have it. And that's a different thing. Envy isn't about wanting to have what someone else has so we can be the same. Envy is about wanting to have more than someone else has so we can have the honor, the glory, the attention that they used to have, that could be given to us, but even more so that it wouldn't be theirs. Envy is always positional. Envy is about the people near us and how we see ourselves ranking compared to them. how we rank ourselves economically compared to those near us, how we rank our marriage to those around us, how we rank our food, how we rank sex, how we rank authority, how we rank glory, how we rank ourselves in comparison to others. And envy is interesting because it never is us comparing ourselves to people that are just clearly better than us at something. Like, a poor person isn't envious of a rich person. A poor person is envious of another poor person who's just a little less poor than they are. You know, there's no one in this room who's envious of, God bless me for, you know, feel bad even using the name, but no one here's like, I'm really jealous of Taylor Swift. You know, I just wish that when I went to town, 80,000 people came and worshipped me. Like, none of you, oh, some Swifties I see. Not funny, Kevin. It's not worship. We just go sing in her direction and raise our hands. That's not praise. Oh, no, we don't do that. We all go to the overflow rooms where they show it on a screen. Anyway, sorry, that's my mistake as campus ministries. Sorry, geez, I'm so confused. The world's gotten so strange the last few years. You're not envious of superstar celebrities because to some degree they're so far beyond you. How could you be jealous? But we're envious of those near us. Aristotle, the philosopher, said, envy grows naturally in relationships between equals. Aristotle said, envy grows naturally in relationships between equals. It is about where we see ourselves in relation to those who we are equal to. Sometimes it's that we'd like to see ourselves a little bit higher. So we think about ways to lift ourselves up over those around us. Our envy leads us to grab resources, to scheme, to come up with strategies or plans to make ourselves look higher. Our envy causes us to curate our image a little bit more, what we wear or how we speak, or maybe what we post online, the curated vision of our life that we offer to others, all in an attempt to lift ourselves higher to escape from envy. But there's an even darker side to envy. The other side to envy isn't about us wanting to be higher, it's about us wishing someone else was lower. And this is like one of those confessional envies, and you can spend some time maybe meditating later on the truthfulness of this, but in my own personal experience, I have a couple times in my life envied. And I will confess that there have been times where my envy of another actually feels like what it really wants is just someone else to have less. For someone else to have some light tragedy befall them. Some light scandal to their name. You know, just light. I don't want them ruined. I don't want them in a ditch. I'm not Joseph's brothers. I just want them, you know, to twist their ankle. You know, like just, I want them just to fall a little bit. And why? Not so that I can have what they have, but I guess just to give myself some sort of psychic relief. You know, it's a fascinating thing what would cause us to envy. What would cause us to wish ill on others, not even for what it gives us. But it does lead to all sorts of disaster. And it does lead to all sorts of behavior that otherwise we'd never practice. Some behaviors that have become so common in our world that we don't even recognize them. There's a line in one of the resources I've been reading, a book that Brian Craig gave me by a person named Henry Fairley. It was written in, I believe, the late 80s. And he said something in it that I wrote down and I'll read to you, but I was shocked to hear him articulate it because just since his writing in the late 80s and early 90s, I feel like it has shifted so far how we view this element of envy that we don't even recognize the problem anymore. So here's his line. He says, one of the evils into which envy leads us is that of backbiting, spite, malignity, accusation. It is well understood that to take away someone's good name is second only to murder as an offense against them. I was like, it's well known? Even back then, just a few decades ago, he says, it's well known, it is well understood, that to take away someone's good name is second only to murder as an offense against them. And that stopped me and kind of frightened me. Because I think we're in a culture right now where we take away people's good name for pleasure, for sport. The sharing on social media, the sharing of rumors and hearsay, the degrading of someone's good name for reasons that we may not understand, because someone said something to us, because we heard something, and now we must spread rumor. We must spread hearsay. We must speak about things that we don't understand, that maybe we couldn't understand, but we have to talk about it, because that's what we talk about. We talk about other people, and if our talk about someone else happens to drag their name through the mud, we'd never consider that our own moral failure, and yet apparently we used to. We used to consider it only next to murder to drag someone's good name through the mud. And I don't know what we do when we know that someone's good name is not as good as we've thought it has been. There's a place for accountability. There's a place for justice. There's certainly a place for consequence. But I feel like we've shifted beyond justice and consequence, and into a sort of gleeful gossip, a small joy that comes around when we hear that someone's good name has been tarnished, because I don't know, maybe at some level it helps us feel like maybe we don't need to be so good after all, because even those we consider good turn out to be fallen. It's caused me to do a bit of reflection this week on a different way I might interact with others, and a different way I might see my own story. So what is the response to envy? If envy is on one side of the polarity, the classic virtue that's being ascribed to antidote or to counteract envy has been charity. Charity, charis, is the Latin word for something that is dear or something that is valued. And apparently acting charitably towards each other, acting costly towards one another, acts as an antidote to envy. When we can recognize that someone else is valuable, when we can give them our attention, when we can give them something of value to us, when we can bless them, when we can pray for them, when we can serve someone else, especially someone else we are actually envious of, it seems to have an antidote effect. It seems to undo the poison. It seems to elevate us from only seeing ourselves and our little story into seeing a larger story. The act of charity, as St. Paul says, thinking of others as greater than ourselves, it has a way of undoing envy's poison. It has a way of getting the claws of envy out of us. And I'm not sure that we can rationalize it all that much. I'm not sure that we would understand why acting charitably undoes envy, but it seems to do so. And I can say that in my own life, when I reflect on times that I've been envious, but I've tried to bless someone all the same, it has done precisely that. It has taken the envy out of my heart and put charity and love in my heart, which is great because it actually makes me feel better about myself. Being charitable to others has a way of lifting our own head. This is the inverse math of the kingdom of God. We lose our life to find it. We bless instead of cursing. We even bless those who curse us, and we find that we are lifted up by seeking the blessing of another. When we bless someone else, it's like we zoom out on the entire game. Picture like that mountain. I've talked before about all of creation being like a mountain, and all these names, all these people kind of vying their way up this mountain, trying to find our position. So long as we're only focused on ourselves, we'll always be obsessed with who might be ahead of us or who might be behind us. But when we see things from God's perspective, we zoom out. We begin to recognize that it's not about me versus anyone else. That none of our stories can actually be compared at all. Your story is your story. Your road is your road. My story is my story. My road is my road. There's no need to be envious because there's nothing to be envious about. It's just someone else's story, and you have your own story. And God will give an answer to each one about their own story, but God will never give us an answer for someone else in someone else's story. The word only comes to each of us as we are. The more that we can hear the word, the good news given to you in your good life, which is enough. When we hear that, we become free to be charitable to others and to be grateful to God. Amen.